Carlisle Holte, for the benefit of those who have not been in my sessions before. I am retired from the religion faculty of St. Olaf College after 30 years of collecting. Well, I never saw a paycheck there. I don't want you to feel that I gave my services, but went to the bank without my handling. It makes a good story. Enjoying retirement, along with, I think, a good many others of you, finding that, at least so far, it's no problem coming to a day and saying, well, I don't really have anything that I have to do. My wife and I are in a second marriage. We lost our spouses, and we're newlyweds. So we have been married less than a year. So we sold our prior homes and bought a townhouse in Northfield, and the bottom line here is that I wanted to say that with all of that stuff flowing together in one rather limited townhouse, there were many days when I could feel, you've got to go out in the garage and sort that stuff. Well,
someday.
Well, I don't have a lot of virtue, but I had enough so that the day before we left, on our way to Holden, we got the car back in the garage. Now when we get home, I can look at it and say, well, I don't have to get at that mess of books today. Now, let me say just a little bit about what I have been doing, and immediate past, present, will continue to do. This is a transplanting of a small part of a course I have done at St. Olaf for a number of years past. It has a long title, which we have carried on, God and Faith in Autobiography. In the studies, I have used a selection, a total actually of 6 autobiographies or journals, of which I have made use here, will make use of 3. Now they are, I would say, for students taking a required religion course, rather more pleasant and easy reading than a book of doctrine or philosophical theology or church history. Because let's admit that even students are intrigued by narrative, by a story, and we all have a story. We have a life. The biography may not have been written, we may not yet have done an autobiography, but it's intriguing. Some of you probably have your grandchildren or your children bugging you to say, well, there were so many interesting things that happened to you. Write them down so they're not lost. Or probably somebody brings a tape recorder and frightens you, as this thing tends to do me, because I wing it through classes, and somehow something is going on there to put down every sneeze and hesitation. But it's important to think about and even to record our lives. Because as we look back, we really cannot resist the drive to say, well, what was happening there? What kinds of influences were there in my home, in my school? What do I remember, and why do I remember that? And I went this way and that way. I did this, and then I did something else. What would have happened if I had stayed in this place? That's rather foolish, of course, but I think we all do it. And then, of course, there are people here who say, well, I belong to this congregation, and I belong to this one. We had this pastor, I remember. I remember my confirmation instruction. Now, it's not quite that simple. When we come to these autobiographies in a religion class, we're saying, now, what religious ideas, what theological ideas are disclosed by this record? I have used C.S. Lewis earlier. This is my 7th presentation in a total sequence of 10. One of the things that I found there very powerfully is Lewis's acknowledgement that God was sovereign. whoever comes in there last or is close to the door will make the keeper of the door, of not the Lord's house, but the kitchen. So my voice doesn't go around the corners and bother the book of Revelation. It will not sound like the voice of the angel, but somebody underneath. I want to stress that, and I see aspects of that idea of the holiness of God in Meura, our present book, because it is important to our understanding of God. It's important to the doctrine of God. The first article of creation is really a statement of the majesty of God. Don't be fooled by the fact that it is as short as it is. And then the second article, the Apostles' Creed, comes out longer. The reason is basically that the first article was not a matter of a great deal of controversy. The doctrine of Christ was being shoved and pushed around, and people were coming up with wild ideas, saying this and that about Jesus. And however that statement was formed, it was beaten out over against that, saying, you're wrong. This is what we believe about Jesus Christ, that he was, is the Son of God, that he lived a real life, that he died a real death. Now, that doesn't sound absurd to us, but there were those, for example, who said, well, Jesus, if he had truly been God, could not have died. Now, how can you explain that? Gods don't die. Gods are the source of life. So the second article is more expanded. All right. Mainly here I want to say, I think that it's a very effective way of laying this on people, students and older people as well, to find Lewis saying in his conversion, he was finally really sort of struck down. He says of himself that he was avoiding God. He didn't want God to interfere. And then he came to a point when he was just sort of taken like a wrestler would take his opponent, forced to his knees. And what was his first admission? God was God. And he can add to that in all reverence, just a hopeless sense. At that moment, I was perhaps the most reluctant convert in all of England. Because God had captured him, and he was squirming, still trying to get away. Sort of like a small child that you catch and say, I'm going to give you a bath.
Another soul. Another soul.
Another soul. Remember, Saul surprised everybody, and I think C.S. Lewis's chain surprised him. He said, is Saul among the prophets? Has he got some kind of faith? Is he doing God's will? And we find, I think, in virtually all of these strong, reflective autobiographies, that sense of the greatness, the holiness of God. Just last evening, in my second of these three talks about this Japanese woman, Ayako Meura, I call attention to one of her problems before she came into the Christian church. And like many people, not just Easterners, but Westerners as well, the problem was not exclusively with what the church was teaching, but the people who claimed that they were believers in this church. And she had heard them praying. And that should impress people, except that she said, she heard these people sort of chattering to God. And she said, if I were to believe in a God, he's not ready yet to believe. I wouldn't be able to talk like that to God. It'd be too great. There's the fear of that God. And we don't like to hear it stressed probably because we say, oh no, you must not be afraid. Gods or boogeymen just go bravely into the world. But the Psalms are full of that awareness of the holiness of God. Moses, when he met God there in the wilderness and saw that strange phenomenon of bush that burned and wasn't consumed, heard the voices said, take off your shoes, you are in a holy place. And the commission came from a God who was a majestic God. Now, I know it's sort of ludicrous to throw in some of these things, but my mind Now, the tapes are getting old and the reels are sort of twisting around. I have heard on occasion bits of probably nearly irreverent tape from Bill Cosby, where he's recording, telling the story of the flood, Cosby style. And no, instead of being just your fine, jumps up and say, "How high, Lord?" You know, as he's going up. Noah's raising objections. Why this and why that? How's this going to work out? I know. And there is one marvelous line when Noah sort of says, according to Cosby, that he's had it. He doesn't know if he really wants to go through with this thing. And the response of God to Noah is, "How long can you tread water?" I think that's a marvelous sermon. Well, that's the kind of thing we're sort of digging into the life, extracting some ore and then running it through the mill and probably adding some catalyst of chemical of thought to say, now you see, what theological religious elements are moving here? So, we talked last evening about suffering, and we want to pick up at that point. Before I do that, before I lay these things down, I'm a little hampered. I'm used to having all those nice stones around for a desk. If you are interested in the current book, I just checked, there is one copy of this left in the bookstore, and in the library reading room against the north wall, there is a shelf with reserved books, and this book should be there. You may read it there, but nobody steal it. And you can't check it out, because it's the only copy the library has. Also, since I mentioned Lewis briefly, on the table, as you come into that area from the corridor, there's a table with a long section of Lewis books, and they are open for loan.
What's the name of that book?
This is Ayako Miura's The Wind is Howling. Thank you for asking title, too, because it gives me a chance to say this much more in introduction. What's that crazy name mean? Well, you should all know it because you know the hymn. Jesus, lover of my soul, let me to thy bosom fly while the nearer waters roll, while the tempest still is high. This is a hymn that the Japanese Christians have translated, and then it's been translated back, and they've kept the Japanese version. They didn't have to worry about the same rhythm. So this reads to our memory then, the tempest still is high, the wind is howling. The spiritual travail that she was going through was like a storm. It's wonderful to come up here on the lady. I've been here once before, and we had a fine ride, but at least coming up a week ago Sunday, our host, the purser, said that there had been one ride up not too many days before when the water was not quiet, and he said they, exaggerated just a little bit, and said they had tried to move one dock about 3 feet. I'm not sure I want to go even down as far as Fields Point if it gets to be a little rough. But for her, that was an image, and she knew enough about storms. You can't be very far from the ocean in Japan. That was the image of all of this turmoil. A wind was howling. And, I very seldom, infrequently, but sometimes do read the ending of the detective story before I've got past 200. I don't think it's a good practice, except here. Since we said that's what is going on, what's the end? The bottom line, the very last line of the book says, "It was a warm spring evening without a breath of wind." So it comes out happily at the end, happily in this, that the disease which had ravaged her body, tuberculosis, which was not easily curable in Japan at that time for lack of proper medication and even proper foods, that's come to a sort of a rest point. And after some romantic problems, she has been married. After her spiritual struggles, she has come to genuine faith in the God of power, but the God of grace in Jesus Christ. Now, We were trying last evening to name suffering, because that was the, well, it wasn't put that way, but I was talking about the problem of suffering as seen here. I've already indicated something here, the physical disease, the spiritual problem. And I simply wanted to broaden the base, because, as was pointed out by one of the group last evening, but the first thing we think about when we talk about suffering is pain. Somebody was mercifully released from terminal cancer. There'd been so much suffering. There was so much pain. But suffering is a much broader, and we went through a number of items, including such things, and most of them we can see at one point or other in The Wind is Howling. Things like loneliness, things like rejection. Ayako was an intelligent female in a society that is pretty much closed to women and to female intelligence. She preferred to talk with men, and not every man, but with men who had something to say, because she did not like to listen to women's gossip. I'm quoting her. Try not to be a chauvinist. But she got heat for that. She was called a flirt. You're always running after the men, aren't you? I'm trying to get yourself a man. And you think you're pretty smart, don't you? Get so uppity. Don't want to listen to these things. You haven't got time for it. And the interesting thing is, there's a man who figures in very prominently, and I will, I think, get to him before too long, Tadashi Mayakawa. Don't worry about how to pronounce these names, because I don't. With these names and with biblical names, if you're ever reading like some of the Old Testament genealogies, just go in as though you know exactly how it should be pronounced, and you will just put down everybody else, even the preacher. Last week, Ralph Gerke of PLU was dealing with the first chapters of Genesis, and there were genealogies. And even with his knowledge of Hebrew, he said, I'm not so sure about how to pronounce that. But Tadashi is a major figure in this. And Tadashi was getting static from the people in his church, because he was being seen too much with Ayako. And she was, this flirtatious, smart aleck type who hadn't been baptized yet. And you got a mingling here of suffering. Ayako, on her own part, doesn't like the kind of thing that's going on. Probably very few of them have talked to her, but sometimes there's a suffering when people are, probably using body language, that great phrase, to show that they really don't think so much of you, but they don't come out and say why. Sometimes the puzzlement of that is almost worse than if they'd say, you are a stinker. But then somebody that you respect is criticized for associating with you. That probably doesn't happen to us too often, but I think we've probably seen it. We've probably seen our children associating with people, and we say, I don't really like that. People are saying, here's this fine young fellow, and that girl you're going with, she doesn't have a good reputation. Or a daughter. She probably has a way of picking up stray kittens, bringing them home, or wounded animals. She also has a way of palling with that person who is on the outside of her class. Why don't you find a nice group? The kind of people that are the leaders and the kind of sort of safe people. You can feel the urgency of suffering back and forth. There are all kinds of ways. It's not a bad life, but there is suffering. And we need to be aware of it, because the scripture is talking, as we can see with just a few references, about the suffering of this life and saying we're foolish to ignore it. I was talking with a lady somewhere here earlier, pardon me if I don't locate her and just as well, because she might not want the kind of publicity. But we were talking about Christian Science. and a way of saying that, you know, things are not bad. For those of us who are sort of reared in the biblical faith, you can't just close your eyes and say it's not there. There are people who are handicapped, and it's not a matter of, you know, whether you're sick or well. It's a matter of whether you're unemployed or employed. It's a matter of whether you're lonely or whether you have friends. All of these things that are real, and you can't dissipate them by closing your eyes or saying, you know, I don't see, I don't hear, I don't feel. That's a realm of unreality. Now, I have to get on and jump over some things. Otherwise, I know you would not stay through the noon hour. You're too clever for that. There are some further elements from the text, and I'd like to pick up a few passages here and there. I mentioned that Iacob sees some of the people in the church as bringing God down to just a common, ordinary, garden variety God, instead of this majestic God. She doesn't seem to hold out much hope that she will see any better attitude in the church. And there is here on page 48, I can get it pretty quickly, I think. There was no solution to my fundamental restlessness. And one of the suffering she goes through is just a sense of meaninglessness. So acute that she tries to commit suicide. She doesn't succeed. Interestingly, she is trying to walk out into the ocean and drown herself. And as she's walking through the sand, she stops to get some sand out of her shoe. She thinks about it later on and says, well, maybe I wasn't in such earnest. No, if you're going to drown yourself, what matter does a little sand in your shoe? She's really sort of grateful that she's rescued, but meaninglessness is there. I was vague about what I was seeking, but nevertheless, it could have been called God. Some people further go to church under the delusion that it is a place where the most holy people gather, but no church is ever a meeting place of the sinless. It is meant for those who know they are sinners, unable to lift their heads before God or man. Therefore, and here is a sort of pessimistic view, unless people seek God without expecting anything from others, they may be driven to despair. But the way is sort of being cleared. It's a puzzler, of course. What does the light that shines through us mean to the world outside? Sometimes it means that it's about as dependable as the power you're holding. Every so often, it isn't so bad now with all the natural light, but last evening I was going on and suddenly we were plunged in darkness. And it's a little bit hard to read your notes or anything else. Fortunately, of course, the same power that took the lights out knocked out that, the tape recorder. There are some things of my stuttering and stammering that will not be recorded for posterity to laugh. Now, there's another thing here, too. The lack of honesty, page 53, holding. And I intimated this a little bit ago, but here is the citation. As always, Tadashi Mayakawa and I met frequently, and when we met, we discussed books and films and the church. Although some members were criticizing me, their consideration for me as a seeker meant they would not tell me frankly what they were thinking. Now, that doesn't sound so bad. Well, they were protecting her. On the other hand, there are times when what we badly need is an openness in dialogue. Somebody who will listen to us and not react negatively, but will deal honestly. And if we ask, what do you think about this? There are people who really want to know. Of course, there are some people who really, after the performance, and they ask, how was that? Don't like to hear, well, If you want my frank opinion, it's Stan.
They would rather have
some stroking, and a certain degree of that may be all right. You see, I've been in the game of grading papers, and thank God it's sort of behind me. Because how you deal with an essay, answer, in honesty, and I'm not just looking for how a student feels about religion, but how do you tell the student, really, this is a bunch of nonsense. I'm going back here to C.S. Lewis, and you see, if I keep dragging this along because most of you did not hear me last week, and you should have. Lewis was smelling out nonsense, sort of like these trained dogs smell out dope in arriving bags when they come through customs. And we think of him as sort of a genial, loving fellow. But he was not about to let people talk foolishness about God. And that means we can't talk foolishness about ourselves or think foolishly. And that, too, is why there is the word of the law. I like the picture. We were at second setting. We always are at the second setting of breakfast. And you probably heard the same vesper. What time is it? Matins, meditation from the man who does the kites. Lovely picture. The string that you have to have, the law. And it is essential. And the law is truth. It is diagnostic. It sets standards. And teachers are mostly law, probably, right, Tom? With some gospel. And I will admit that there have been some struggling souls who have gotten the benefit of the doubt. But there's still wonderful stories that come out of those 30 years. One teacher had a student complain, why did you give me a D minus on my final grade? And he said, well, I just didn't have the heart to give you an F. Okay. Suffering of various kinds. And I've got to throw some things down here and hope that they don't all get messed up. My wife sees me doing this sort of thing on the bed, and I think she wonders how I ever make any slightest sense out of it. I want to stop here because I have been told, and the law has been holding at me, although I've been trying to fly higher, that I should give some time for discussion. My experience last week was that, okay, now we'll discuss. We have a minute left. The way to get around that is to put in some discussion earlier, before we begin what I call in class the two-minute shuffle. Students are very great at that. They watch the time, and you can always tell whether you can see the clock or not, or feel it. You know, getting all pulled together. You might as well forget it, except the dean might be out there saying, you never run your classes full time, do you? What I want to just talk about, and I want some contribution from you, this is not your test, but in the main, we talked about suffering. We talked about it as something that is harmful, disturbing. So let's flip that and talk about what positive things may come from suffering. And I don't want this to be too glib, so we're too quick. But there are some good things. I'd like a volunteer to read just three verses with no genealogies from the letter to the Romans. I have it marked here. Somebody want to volunteer close up? Okay.
What is it?
Romans 5, verses 3, 4, and 5. And I trust you, but I want to get my text up here too. Okay.
More than that, we rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance. And endurance produces character, and character produces hope, and hope does not disappoint us, because God's love has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit, which has been given to us.
Okay. Very positive, isn't it? We rejoice in our sufferings. I see some wild things sometimes, but I couldn't match up what Paul says somewhere. It's sort of a joke, makes us stop and think. We glory in tribulation, the King James Version. What's one word that we're familiar with from the King James or here? The virtue, the benefit of suffering.
Patience.
Patience, yeah. You can see, you've got some of the evidence here. I got a little more here. I don't quite have normal vision. I could use this and read this way, but it doesn't work quite so well. I'm sort of frantic if I don't have something here, because even with the glasses, we have a peculiar notion. If you come out of the ophthalmologist, the optometrist with a pair of glasses, 20/20 vision. Well, 25,000 and 20/80. You know something about it. That's not very good. But I keep working at it. I try not to sputter too much. And of course, I remember very distinctly, I think I was crying too much in class one day, and a blind girl said, "But you can see something, Mr. Hogan." But just to say, well, you're learning patience. It'll be good for you, because patience will come. So what are some of the other things? And here we will think about positive. There is patience that can come. What else might there be?
Ability to understand others.
Ah, it's marvelous. You establish a community. You see somebody else, you see somebody with a patch over the eye, or see somebody else with a thick glasses, and you're a community.
Passion.
Right?
Passion. Passion.
Passion. I got this here too. Okay. genuine feelings. Your feelings are stirred up. There's passivity, and then there's passion, and it's not just, I think, as we are so keyed to our culture, we think of sexual passion. Oh. Be still my heart. But Paul is a passionate person. He is longing to do something for people. Some other things. Yes?
Empathy.
Empathy. Right.
Empathy.
A feeling along with. A passion with somebody. Who understands the lonely person? Person who has known loneliness. Some of you were at the forum last evening, and we probably were puzzled, or somewhat informed, about homosexuality. Probably had some franker admissions of practicing homosexuals than we had ever heard. But did you hear that they're looking for somebody who can feel with them, sense this problem? And I will not go further into that. Got enough tough problems here. But this is what people are looking for. And people come together. You will see in the whole story, if you ever read it, of Alcameira, that it is the those people who are in the hospital suffering from tuberculosis, those who are threatened by a lingering decline into death, or the sudden death that can come by accident when they are supposed to have something done and they're punctured, and the needle goes into the wrong place, punctures along, and they die, or hits a vein, and they're, Iacco tells about one person, a patient who goes off. He's but ready to be discharged from the hospital. He's going to have this one process. Something went wrong. Bingo. It's gone. But the sense of feeling one with. Some more things.
In physical or spiritual suffering, there is a strength that comes to compensate through the suffering, so that one becomes stronger in the suffering in other phases of their lives, or in other, if it's physical, in other senses. If one is not functioning perfectly, the other senses become stronger. And in your spiritual being, if there's some a spiritual lack, somehow maybe there's compensation in strengthening of other spiritual attributes.
Let's carry that to another stage. Here is somebody who has compensated in some way, who overcomes a handicap. What about the people who witness that? What happens to them?
It's sort of a lesson for others too, in observing it perhaps.
Right. I think you've all heard this, and many of you are demonstrating it. There are older people who have such a positive outlook on life that younger people look at them and say, how wonderful. Here is somebody probably carrying certain infirmities, no longer working, no longer highly active member of society, and what a beautiful state. You transcend some problems like this. There are people who do see and appreciate it, understand. One of the difficulties, I think, in our culture is that we have all kinds of ghettos, not just for racially isolated people, but we have retirement home ghettos, nursing home ghettos, hospital ghettos, mortuary ghettos, and a lot of people know just the geography to stay away from all of them, because all they can see about that is the negative aspect. Look how we shut people off to a hospital, and then we might go to see them if there's time. It may not be time, we might get out of the hospital and get well, but our confrontation with this, and particularly with the long-range illness, is very, very limited. I speak about a younger group, students who have never visited a hospital, who've never been in a hospital, who have never experienced a death in the family, have not gone to a funeral service of a friend or relative. That's out there. And of course, we have a college which does not have total accessibility. It's a rarity to see somebody going around in a wheelchair. And it's a shock. But there can be, call it a testimony if you want to use the language, and the experience of conquering problems can be a positive influence on others. I would rather have perfect vision. I would rather still be able to drive. Somebody said I should play golf. Well, in the first place, I'm not sure that I could hit the ball. In the second place, if I hit it, it'd be enough to feel like I was something of a golfer. I couldn't see where it went. And I don't mean to complain. I'm a lot better off than the girl who said that you can see something. Okay, let's move on, because the announced topic, and we do have some more time for it, is living for others. And that we want to sort of name. Probably I should get into one other area here that I think is essential understanding of sort of the biblical view of suffering and its potential. There are Psalms that we don't read too often, because we don't read all through the Psalms, and sometimes these Psalms sound offensive. We talked about the holiness of God, and yet we have the psalmist, whoever he or she was, sort of rearing back and saying, I don't like what's happened. I don't like the way you run the world. There's no way to run a drugstore. We have Psalms called the Psalms of Lament. And here is a short one, a typical one, that gives sort of a good perspective on this group of Psalms, and they're scattered throughout.
This one I'm going to look at is Psalm 13, but we're very familiar with another one because Jesus quoted from it on the cross. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? And that, of course, does not seem to be a pious thing to say, even for Jesus. Had he lost his faith, people say, well, he was not just saying to the, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? But he was calling up the whole of this psalm. And I am grateful because in a time of testing, when my wife, my first wife, was dying of cancer, my pastor, who knew about the anguish that some of us were going through, because his own son, a teenager in high school, had had both legs amputated because of cancer. And the second amputation was so high that this boy is riding around in his wheelchair at St. Thomas College this fall again, I think, second year in college, because no prosthesis can be attached. And I don't know how many trips that family made. I don't know how many operations Rolf had. I know this, that his peers in school learned a great deal from him because of the way he carried it. Now just interject here, an excursus, I'm full of them. He was in a German class, and typically the German classes made a trip to Germany for a few days to see where the people speak this. And Rolf said, well, I'm not sure, you know, I'm going down to Mayo's again, and who knows, I might have another minor bit of surgery. But don't stay home because of me, go through with it. Well, he got a decent bill of health so he could join the group, and here he is, with no legs, going along Germany with his able-bodied friends. And there are two points here. The one is that his friends carry him, and the other is that he is willing to be carried, willing to be seen all over there. Well, Pastor Jacobson preached on Psalm 13. And there are, it's a sort of a nice outline, segments here, very short ones. If I remember correctly, the first in the Psalm of Lament is a protest. The second is a petition. And the third, I had to work hard to get this other P in here, protest, petition, and praise. So you make a cycle, and that's what changes the character of the Psalms. They are not just, constantly. I know complaining, I know a worse word, but I won't use it here because it'd be offensive. But there are some people who are interminable, intolerable complainers. They just wet blankets. What about the psalmist? How long, O Lord, wilt thou forget me forever? How long wilt thou hide thy face from me? How long must I bear pain in my soul and have sorrow in my heart all the day? How long shall my enemy be exalted over me? Petition. Consider and answer me, O Lord my God. Lighten my eyes, lest I sleep the sleep of death. Lest my enemies say, I have prevailed over him. Lest my foes rejoice because I am shaken. Praise. But I have trusted in thy steadfast love. My heart shall rejoice in thy salvation. I will sing to the Lord because he has dealt bountifully with me. That's the magnificence of that kind of deep, pious complaint. Now, this is what we see in Mayuri and her experience. Got the notes are here somewhere. We pointed out very briefly yesterday that the sufferings of others are met, and this is sort of just the very tip of the iceberg, by other people who are concerned, will be helpful. And that's the starting point then for talking about living for others. And I want to give a sort of twist to that later on, but let's look at some of the statements here. And they come early in the book, and they are sort of piled up, and they're concrete statements. So we're not just dealing in abstract definition. I mentioned Tadashi, a young Christian, only a couple of years older in terms of chronological age than Iyako. They had known one another earlier. He is an aspiring medical student. He also has tuberculosis. He will die. She will live. And he has been in this buddy relationship, talking to her, using his relationship of an old friend to speak honestly. He comes to her room in the tuberculosis hospital one time and sees another patient come in and say, we're going to have a little party tonight. I smuggled in a bottle of sake, that Japanese equivalent of, the Norwegians have a nice white liquid that burns like fire, and the Russians have one, and the Irish have rice liquor, powerful. And this is put on the shelf in Ayako's room to be reserved. It isn't very much, enough for three people probably to have a sip. And Tadashi says, you have no business to be drinking sake. You're sick. You have no business to smoke. And of course, I portrayed her as resisting this kind of thing. No, you were talking like that. What difference does it make? And her meaningless attitude to life, oh, why shouldn't she? It's sort of like the condemned man ate a hearty breakfast. Why shouldn't he be a glutton? Why shouldn't he drink and smoke? He's going to be hanged by the neck until dead in a certain specified time. But there is more than just this kind of verbal chastisement. I told him about that night by the sea. This was when she had attempted suicide. He gazed at me grimly without saying a word, but soon he looked bleakly away. Much later I realized that, knowing he had not many years to live, he had decided to devote his remaining life to me. Now, the rest of his life would go on. He would make motions hoping that he might survive, studying and so on. But this was a concern, and it is that phrase, devote his remaining life to me. That's one of our keys here. Then a little later on, something really reiterating. Tadashi is kicking himself now because he hasn't been succeeding. I don't mind dying if it means you will live. But I'm such a poor Christian, I have come to see that I have no power to save you. That's why I'm striking myself as a punishment for being so useless. And just a few lines later, Tadashi acknowledges, he did not want me for himself. He wanted me to discover the real meaning of life. I said there's romance here. It certainly would have flowered, but at this point, Tadashi is not entertaining any hope of being her husband or her lover or anything like that. Did not want me for himself. He wanted me to discover the real meaning of life. And yet another, piling up here, I hope a little bit more, not just in a paper stack pile, but a little more complex perspective. Thinking about him striking his foot with a stone, I discovered what serious meant. The word serious ought only to be used when one lives for the sake of other people. Now that word, and we looked at this briefly last evening, is interesting. Because Ayako had used it previously in sort of a negative way. She said, being serious is suffering. And of course, you can very well see that. The people who are distressed in the world, who have passionate causes, are serious about life. And then there are the people who just breeze through life. Oh, well, that's no problem. Can't do anything about it. What do you waste time on those concerns, you know? Do-gooders, why worry? Live, enjoy, don't get tangled up in these things. They just get in the way of the enjoyment of life. And we certainly know enough about a pleasure-mad culture to know that that's a problem. On the other hand, the word serious ought only to be used when one lives for the sake of other people. And that's the other side of the coin, if you will. Now, a change comes about in Eyako, and I've got several pages here. I'm not going to inflict them all on you. Let me see here. God had already prepared something for me to do at a time when I could do nothing but grieve for Tadashi Mayakawa. I wrote a card to each person and sent them the magazine. This is a Christian magazine. But I received so many letters that in no time at all the copies I had to hand were exhausted. And this is a significant change, because Ayako will say she was simply thinking of her own situation, her own problem, and sort of saying, oh, poor me, stuck, cuss me. Every friend in Norway met some years ago. And you'll pardon my Japanese if I say first the statement that she tossed out and then translate it. Enver tänker på sig själv. Det är varje som tänker på mig. Everybody is thinking about his or herself. I'm the only one who's thinking about me. I think that's marvelous. That's what Ayako is doing. And she was fretting, she was feeling her own indebtedness that she could not repay. And now she begins to come out, and a lot of the ministry that she does is by mailing out these little sort of gospel tracts, whatever they were, papers, and engaging in correspondence. It's a commonplace, but it's still part of living for others. Here too, just in terms of the Psalm of Lament, I had openly voiced my dissatisfaction to God and had gone on complaining to him, but I did not stop believing in him. That is something that we probably need to recognize more, that there are people who on the outside seem to be pretty faithless, and yet they have not rejected God. Just one more part here, I think. And this is after Tadashi had died. Suddenly I realized how I was thinking. It appalled me. Wasn't I supposed to be living as Tadashi Mayakawa had wanted to? Now, there's a stage here. He said, I'm giving the rest of my life for you. And she is picking it up and saying, her life then should be lived as he had wanted her to. If I had taken over his life, shouldn't I be living it with determination? Shouldn't I expect to get well again, along with the other sick friends God had given me? I pulled myself up. Nothing would come from being engrossed in my own grief. No, my own life was withering away. Once the period of mourning ended on May 2nd, I decided to receive all those who came to visit me. For a whole year, I had never slept before 1:14 a.m., the time when he died. This was wrong. And at last I knew it. Here is grief that is artificially perpetuated. You can see, just psychologically, she was programming herself to remember that moment in dedication, a false dedication to him, and it was destroying her own spiritual growth. But a year, meaningless grief. But get out. There's one story that I just will allude to. One symbol of this is in the hospital, there was a teenage girl who had attempted suicide, and she came and finally and talked to Ayako and received her as a friend. Meant more to her than Ayako realized. Sometime later, Ayako went to a different hospital. This girl, still in hospital, signed out to go home, and she didn't get home, and they said, where is she? And what happened was that this girl took French leave and looked up Ayako, the one person who is concerned about her. And of course, that's going to impress you. There's somebody who is dependent on you. You're helpless, but somebody needs you. Now, I want to give just a little bit of a preliminary twist, as I said, and in a sense go back to not C.S. Lewis, but a very close friend of his, Charles Williams, who wrote some very strange books. And as usual, there will be some of this that I will use as a beginning and a tie over tomorrow when I'm on at 7 o'clock. I won't know what to do with myself. I don't have a class for over 24 hours. Oh, I haven't written on a chalkboard yet. Some of these things I just have to do or I'll lose my certificate of teaching. There's the word, co-inherence. As I say, to live for others, Tadashi wanted to dedicate the rest of his life to Hayako. They're not really very well named. There are certain aspects that are not brought out. I think that Lewis, or Williams rather, the friend of Lewis, does some clarifying here. And I'm going to pick out just a few sentences here to give you an initial idea. I'd be glad to talk with you who will not be back because you're leaving or just want to get an advance look-see. Anytime you can catch me. We're going to make kites this afternoon, I think. And I don't see making a kite for 2 hours. But that's one place I'll be, and hang around in the snack shop. I'll very likely pass through there just to see if any of my friends are there. All right, here is the poet Auden introducing this book. He says, "When later I began to read his books, I realized why this was so. The basic theme which runs through all of them is a doctrine of exchange and substitution, a way of life by which it was clear he himself lived." A little farther on, "The doctrine might be briefly summarized as follows. The first law of the spiritual universe, the real city, is that nobody can carry his own burden. He only can, and therefore he must, carry someone else's." That's striking. Because it, again, flips the coin and says, we can't meet sufferings, problems by ourselves. We need to learn to lean. We need to learn to accept the free grace of God. And we need to discover what we can do for somebody else. Now this gets to be sort of mystical, and I am just running out of time, although I think I have a few minutes by the proper clock. In a strange, weird story that Charles Williams wrote in one of his strange, weird novels, there's a woman, a young woman, who has a secret terror. She has seen herself coming walking to her. More terrifying to her than going out west here and seeing a bear.
You mean a vision?
It's what's called a doppelganger, my double. And it has apparently happened. He makes mention of the great German poet Goethe. And they have a name for it, doppelganger, my double. And, how would any of us feel if we were walking on here and said, hey, I'm meeting myself coming back? At any rate, this woman has the secret terror. And she gets into conversation. Actually, there is a poet in the area, it's an involved story, but he says, something is bothering you. And she hasn't been admitting this to anybody because they wouldn't understand. She said, oh, no. I said, really? Something is bothering you. And finally, she says, well, I have this terror of my double. And there were just a couple of things here, and we'll come back to them tomorrow again. "At all my life," she answered, "at intervals, long intervals, I know, months and years sometimes between this vision, whatever you want to call it, only it's quicker now. Oh, it's insane. No one could believe it, and yet it's true. It's your absolute likeness. It's true. It comes from a long way off and it comes up towards me, and I'm terrified. But he said, and this is about her fear, that I don't quite understand. You have friends. Haven't you asked one of them to carry your fear? Now he begins, hey, this guy's way off. Ask somebody to carry your fear. Carry my fear, she said, sitting rigid in her chair, that her arms which had lain so lightly pressed now into the basketwork, and her long, firm hands gripped as if they strangled her own heart. How can anyone else carry my fear? Can anyone else see it and have to meet it? And he says, you're mixing up two things. Think a moment and you'll see. The meeting it, that's one thing, and we can leave it till you're rid of the other. It's the fear we're talking about. Has no one ever relieved you of that? Haven't you ever asked them to? She said, no. Will you let me do it for you? Do it for me? It can be done, you know, he went on. It's surprisingly simple. There's no one else you care to ask. Why not use me? I'm here at your disposal. We could so easily settle it this way. Then you needn't fear it, at least. And then again, for the meeting, that might be a very different business if you weren't distressed. And he goes on, and I fear you will become restless. Now, is this just some weird man-made answer, or is it an extension out of a very commonplace Christian statement? Jesus Christ died for me. The life which we now live is the life of Christ. Christ himself bore our suffering on the cross. I talked a little bit with somebody the other day, and I said, you know the old hymn? What a friend we have in Jesus, all our sins and griefs to bear. But we have to name this, and we have to see it as a way to live with our fears, our problems, and the way to be, as I know, along the way here at Holden, we were here once before, you would hear, we are little Christs. How are we? Not just by saying, but by saying, let me carry your fear. It's a powerful image. And even if we had more time, we'd want still more time and more time to think about. So leave you with us. Thank you.